Good afternoon. My name is Mercedes Harness. I am the coordinator for the Friends of the Homer Library. Thank you for being here. It's not only important to vote, but it's important to be informed when you vote, and that's what this event is all about, is to get to know your candidates a little bit better. Sarah Vance and Paul Seaton, thank you for being here. And with that, I will turn the event over to Sean Campbell, who is a board member and will be our moderator this afternoon.
Before we do begin, I want to review some expectations. Targeted questions are not allowed. This is intended to keep the spirit of the forum friendly and even-handed. Remember, this is a forum, not a debate. Community members have been submitting questions in advance at the library, K-Bay Cafe, Captain's Coffee, and Two Sisters Bakery. All of you, and thank you for coming. You may submit questions to FHL board members. Throughout the forum, on the note cards provided, we will attempt to address all the issues raised in these questions. And I want to review the structure of our forum. Each candidate will be given an opportunity to give a 3-minute opening statement. We will then begin the questions. Candidates will have 2 minutes to respond to each question at the moderator's discretion. Candidates may provide a follow-up, which will be limited to 1 minute. In the last 30 minutes, response time will be reduced to 1 minute. With 30 seconds to follow up. Each candidate will be given an opportunity to give a 1-minute closing statement. Keeping all of this in mind, let's begin. Mrs. Vance, I'll direct the first question to you. Please explain why you are running for office.
Are we going to have an opening statement first?
Oh, you are. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you so much for coming. This is really exciting to see so many people involved in the political process and wanting to learn more about the issues that are facing Alaska. You know, I was just thinking, here we are in the Homer Public Library, and my dream of Alaska began in the library. I was probably 4, maybe 5 years old, and would pull out a big picture book of all the beautiful scenes that cover the vast country here in Alaska, in the beauty and the sunsets. And I remember specifically the beautiful Native dancers, and I thought, you know what? Their grace and their beauty is something that is so unique and significant about Alaska that it's something of value that we need to preserve and hold on to. And it just really gives a sentiment to me right now as we're here in this library all together to conserve the Alaska that we know and love. The Alaska that I grew up with. And that's why I'm running, is I want Alaska to be safe and vibrant and bursting with opportunity. And I'm doing my part to hold on to that, because it seems like it's always being threatened in one form or another. And this is my civic duty, is to do what I can in my part with this piece of the puzzle. So thank you for coming out. There's a few platforms that I have been raising of importance that I believe are important to all of Alaska. That is to restore the PFD to the people, to repeal SB 91, the soft on crime bill, to reject a state income tax, to expand job opportunities, and to advocate for seniors and veterans. I value every Alaskan and your contribution to what you've invested into this great state, large or small, whether you're a construction worker, a teacher, a veteran, or a homemaker. You have given and built to this great state. And I just want to say thank you, and thank you for being here to be a part of this process, because this is all ours to walk and journey through together. So thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for being here this afternoon. I'm Paul Seaton. I've enjoyed being your representative since 2003. My wife, Tina, is here with me today, as well as my son, Rand, and daughter-in-law, Lauren. I can tell you this much, that Tina goes down to Juneau with me every year, and this would be a much harder job without family down in Juneau with me. I came to Alaska in my college days on a rock hunting trip, and I ended up completing college in Fairbanks with a master's in teaching. I had a tree clearing business, and I was the manager of the muskox farm, which led, believably, to owning a boat and fishing in Cook Inlet. But that's another story. So we decided that we needed a bigger boat for halibut fishing, and Tina and I went to the East Coast. We bought a 47-foot shrimp boat, brought it through the Panama Canal and up to Alaska. For several years later, we expanded our tendering operation because we halibut fished and tendered. So I had four tenders. We hired captains and crews for all of those. I have a master's of science degree, which explains the charts that you see. And I just wanted to say that those two diagrams are on the Legislative Finance website, and my campaign copied those for you today, but they're publicly available there. Our marriage has survived two kids, six boats, and four houses, and remodeling a number of apartments. And so many of you know me through connections in the community here, and those are things like the Homer Foundation, the Rotary, Little League, Ketchumak Bay Research Reserve, the Methodist Church, and as a businessman, and as the husband of the Girl Scout organizer here in town. So why is this important to you? Well, I think it's important because as small businessmen, it became a really important piece of my values to be a problem solver as a core attitude that I have. In politics, I've been your independent voice on the Kenai Peninsula. I'm running as a nonpartisan candidate because I believe in working together across party lines to solve the big problems of Alaska. I support a sustainable budget that funds essential services and the PFD for future generations. I continue to promote education, repairing the criminal justice system, and improving the health of our residents. This year I created a new law that early funded education system, and that was, is this 3 minutes? 2 minutes.
So I think that both of you kind of addressed this, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to explain anything further why you're running for this position.
Again, I want to bring back the character of small town Alaska that we all know and love. Growing up here, we knew that if we got stranded on the side of the road that someone, the next person to come along, would stop and help us. Because after all, this is Alaska, and it may be us that are stranded up on the side of the road the next time, whether it's, you know, stuck in the mud or in a snow berm. And there were more times that I was rescued by the next guy with a good truck that to pull my car out, you know, when I was in high school. And now, people don't feel safe anymore. They have a sense of vulnerability that they don't know who that person is. And we lock our doors at night, and we lock them in the daytime, and we're afraid of who our neighbors might be or what they might be doing. That's concerning to me. I want there to be a hope again, and the sense of opportunity. I want to do my part in what we can as a community and as a representative to bring that back. I don't consider those days of my childhood bygone days. I refuse to accept anything less than the beautiful and wonderful, vibrant Alaska that I grew up with. I believe that we can achieve that again, but it's going to take a partnership, not only in our legislature, with administration, but also as a community, to be able to return to the vibrant communities that we love here. And that includes feeling safe in a time of great opportunity. So I'm going to do my part, and I thank you for doing yours.
Thank you. When I decided to run again this year, I thought about my son, Rand, and daughter-in-law, Lauren, who are building a new house. They run my fish tender during the summer, and they are also, Rand is a teacher in school. They depend on a stable economy, sustainable fisheries, and consistent education funding. And so I believe that my experience, my dedication to developing solutions, and my ability to compromise are needed in the House at this time. And so that's why I'm running again for state representative.
So I'll direct this question to you, Representative Seaton. First, what do you see as our region's greatest challenge, and how do you propose addressing it?
Well, the greatest challenge I think our region has is a stable economy, and it's going to be very difficult, but we have to look at new sources of jobs. Some of those range from agriculture. We have passed laws that will help us with the funding of local foods. We also have the new pot, marijuana, our only new source of tax right now. And we have industrial hemp that we passed. So that's three agricultural things that can bring stability to us. We've also aided the economy with renewable resource and energy efficiency grants. And we have to look forward to the development of our economy, but it's really difficult in a time when our budget is not balanced. We don't have current incomes balanced with current expenditures, so we've been depleting our savings over time. Under this situation, the options for the state government are very few, and we are just spending down savings. That's not the way to go, and we need to balance our budget much more carefully.
I began thinking about the greatest challenge that I see with this area, and at first my response was that we needed jobs as well. But we have jobs available. There's a lot of positions out there that are not being filled. And it's across the state that there are open positions, but they only pay $10 and $12 an hour. But why aren't people filling them? Where are the young people that are holding these jobs? When I was in high school, we knew that if we could work hard, we could make a lot of money for the summer, whether it was out on the halibut charter like I was, or as a deckhand, you know, making good tips. You could earn a good wage and be able to spend it however you please, whether it was for college or buying this new snow machine. But now those jobs are being competed with the adults that are holding down their second and third job to make ends meet. What I see as the overall challenge for our community is a lack of hope. We have more people that are on drugs and alcohol and addicted to the opioids and other substances more than ever before. We have more homeless in our community. We need a sense of hope and of opportunity again. And that is not something that is going to come through legislation, but it can come through stimulating the economy, through us banding together as a community and seeing what we can do to address the problems here. When the crime is so high and the hope is so low, it's going to take each and every one of us. These are the things that we can come together with and bring solutions. And as a representative, I'm going to represent you and the ideas and the solutions that you bring to this hopelessness. I believe that we can be that place of opportunity where people have the sense that we can bend together no matter how big the storm. This is what we bring, and Homer is one of the brightest places in the state to do that, and I hope to bring that to our state government.
Building off of that, Mrs. Vance, what does it mean to be pro-development, and how do you envision protecting and promoting all facets of the Alaskan economy?
I think that comes down to the idea of stewardship. Stewardship was one of the very first principles that I learned, and maintaining and taking care of the earth that we have, but also anything that is given to our hand. It doesn't just amount to natural resources, but anything that we are given, we are meant to steward it and to learn to multiply it and make it where it is sustainable for the long term and able to share with our neighbor. And that's we can apply to any industry, any facet of anything that we are given, whether it be our natural resources of our fish, our oil, The garden that we grow in our backyards, everything is a matter of stewardship and finding the right balance so that we don't use it to where it is unavailable anymore, but how we can learn to take what is in our hand and multiply it. That's what pro-development means to me, and how we can bridge the gap between industries that are often feel like they're competing one against each other. We all live and work and reside here. How can we get along and say, let's reason together? These are the things that will create a unity instead of having two different industries opposing one another. We can make this work. Some have to give, some have to take, but sometimes it can be the teeter-totter back and forth to make that work. And stewardship is a principle that all of us can agree on, that we can work for the betterment of Alaska.
And Sean, was that question pro-development?
Pro-development, yeah.
I consider myself pro-development, and that means that I am in favor of improving our economy, but it's got to be done in a sustainable manner. Many people consider pro-development someone that is going to go full bore ahead without consideration of the long-term impacts, which is something we really have to worry about. One of the things that is necessary if you want to do things right is to plan all of the consequences and take those into consideration up front. That's the permitting process. And that permitting process doesn't matter whether you're talking about getting a fire permit review of a public building to make sure that it's safe for fires or earthquakes, or whether it is protecting our salmon streams with the permitting process and having those development standards up front. And so pro-development does mean that we go forward, but we have that contingent upon balancing the different resources so that we don't degrade the existing situations that we have.
So we're starting to get questions, and both of these go hand in hand and build off of what both of you were talking about in many ways. What are your priorities on resource development when it potentially conflicts with fisheries, as well as your position on pebble mine?
Well, let's start with the last part first. I think the pebble mine is the wrong mine in the wrong place. That's just a start, but the first part of your question was, again?
What are your priorities on resource development when it potentially conflicts with fisheries?
Oh, thank you. Yes, and that's one of the reasons why I'm in favor of the Stand for Salmon initiative. It sets out standards. I believe every project developer should know what the standards are they need to design their project for. Right now, we have a very amorphous thing that just says, the commissioner is going to protect fish. So that's a political decision, and a project developer really doesn't have standards and guidelines to design their project on. I think that designing standards are there for not only the permittee, but also the reviewers when they are reviewing those for a permit, then they know what they're supposed to be reviewing on. Everybody should be on the same page, and those standards should be in statutes so that it's clear to everyone. Balancing things going forward, part of the problem is that we no longer have a coastal zone management plan here in Alaska. We're the only coastal state. We have 50% of all the coastline in the U.S., and we're the only coastal state that doesn't have a coastal zone management plan. If we had that, we wouldn't even be looking at Proposition 1 because we would have a public process where we get the early designs taken care of at the time. So, was it? No, okay. Anyway, I guess that wraps up that.
When it comes to Pebble Mine is undergoing their due process. Just like we want due process for ourselves or our own company, they are going through that, and I believe that we should allow them that process because that is something that we value as Americans for any company, any industry, or any individual. they are taking those steps under the guidance of Alaskans. And that is something that I take comfort in, is that they have a lot of pieces to the puzzle and a lot of different people who are going to be looking at this process. I have not weighed in on what that should be. I think we need to focus on what we can do right now to help sustain our fisheries, and that it comes through proper management and science. And when I was at the roundtable on the fisheries, they have been making progress in looking at what is affecting our salmon and our fisheries, and there's still many variables that are left unknown, but they're in the process of looking at what we can do with the salmon runs, because that's a concern here on the Cook Inlet that is affecting our fishermen. But we can't impede the process that one company is undergoing when we need to be focusing on how we can strengthen our fisheries and what we can do in the meantime.
Both of you talked about conservation, and I wanted to ask this question to explain how you think climate change will affect our economy.
There are so many variables of climate change that I asked some current legislators if we have numbers on that, because the governor has been speaking with the board that he has been working on this. We don't have any hard data on the actual numbers of how it's affecting the state right now, but that is something that we are waiting on to in order to make the good decisions. That is something that I need to get educated on more, but I'm understanding that it has greatly affected our state in many ways. We're seeing many more fires than we have in the past. Seward is being flooded right now like crazy. We're seeing a lot more things that is going to affect and deteriorate our infrastructure at a 10 to 20% quicker rate than before. These are issues that will cost us a lot of money, and I think part of the thing that we can do is to prepare. If we know that we're going to have a 10 to 20% increase in having to maintain some of the things just from the weather changes due to the rising temperatures here, then we need to focus on building a stronger and more balanced budget so that we can replenish our savings accounts, so that we can have money available for the natural disasters that come, but also how we can address the ocean acidification along with the science that we're looking to for our fisheries, and be able to have that conversation. But when we do that, we have to look at it from a balanced approach and focus on the education on what we can do instead of what we can't.
Well, we really don't know what all the effects are going to be right now. We do know that ocean acidification and warming of the temperatures are affecting many of the economic species that we fish, whether it's crab or whether it's salmon, making tremendous changes. We do know that we are having tremendous effects of these rising temperatures on washing villages into the sea without the sea ice to prevent the winter storm damage that's causing huge impacts in those areas. That rising sea level is going to make huge changes. We here in Homer are somewhat helped because we have glacier rebound, which is actually raising the level of the ground as the glaciers melt over here across the way at the same rate that the ocean is rising, but that's not the case for everywhere in Alaska. We have increasing traffic in the Arctic, and that is going to give some economic boost with the necessity of ports, transportation up there. It's also going to give Homer some necessity to have support vessels for any economic activities that are going there. We do have some positives, tourism, you know, the longer seasons. We have longer seasons for agriculture in this state, as we've been able to see. I mean, look out here now, it's almost November and we haven't had a frost yet. So those are some of the things. We also have renewable energy that we should be activating much more quickly so that we can lower our carbon footprint and burn less carbon. One of the problems we have is coal. We have a lot of coal, and there is a real conundrum as to whether economics makes sense when we have such a detriment of putting more carbon in the atmosphere.
We have a couple more questions about climate change and renewable energy. So we'll build off of that. Recently, the United Nations issued a report on global warming. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report highlights a number of climate change impacts that could be avoided by limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to 2 degrees Celsius. It states that 1.5 degrees Celsius is possible but requires unprecedented and urgent action. One, do you believe that limiting climate change to 1.5 degrees Celsius is important, as stated in the climate report? And if so, what is Alaska's responsibility to help curtail the rise in temperature?
Well, thank you. Yes, I believe it's very important. I mean, we're seeing the effects here rapidly. I don't know how we're going to get there. I mean, we have a national energy policy that is not much of a policy. And so we are going to have to, as a population, decide that we really need to address this that is going to so dramatically affect our kids and our grandkids and their future and what could happen. So I do believe that we all know what a greenhouse is, and we know what greenhouse gases are and how they work. If we stop them right now, they're still going. We've got this positive feedback loop that we really need to worry about warming of the Arctic, and if the sequestered carbon up there starts coming out, then we are really in big problems. I addressed coal a minute ago. We need to go to the lowest carbon sources. Alaska has a great opportunity for renewable energy. And renewable energy and super insulation can reduce tremendously our need for that energy to be burned. And so we need to be proactive on the front of how much energy do we need, how do we conserve it, and then how do we produce it in a way that is the least carbon offensive. And so limiting coal production, increasing natural gas in the short term, but we need to have community-wide solar farms and things. Like there was one, HEA was looking at it out by Anchor Point. It had a 4-4 tie vote and died. But we need massive, not just on single rooftops, but our greatest control would be in super insulating homes.
The reality is, when it comes to the emissions, Alaska and the United States are acting pretty reasonably as far as their control of that. It is the other major countries in the world who are ignoring the importance of this. And China is one of the largest countries who happens to want our natural gas. I think that we could have a hand in putting some social and trade pressure on them to do their part in this process for our natural gas. They want our LNG. I believe that we could have a conversation that says, we'd like you to be more responsible because you're going to be taking our good clean energy. We need you to clean some things up. There's a bargaining process that we can use to our advantage to help in the overall global atmosphere here, not just here in the state.
So we're about a half an hour in, and we've been having some in-depth questions about the economy. Here's one that's a little bit lighter. Considering that we're in a library, what is your favorite book?
You know, I've always loved history, and my high school senior history teacher is Patty J is here, and do you remember that? I don't remember if that was the first time that I was introduced to the U.S. Constitution, but it was definitely a highlight, and I thought, oh my goodness, there are people who study and have to pass this test in order to become a naturalized citizen. And the U.S. Constitution has obviously been highlighted as an importance to me, but that, and controversially enough, the Bible is also my favorite book. With those two documents together, one teaches me freedom and the other teaches me liberty. And those are two things that I value the most and that I will fight for, not only for myself and my family, but anyone else, regardless of what I agree with or disagree with you. That liberty and freedom is yours to value just as much as I value it for myself. And that's what I enjoy about both of those documents, is that every time I open them, I learn something new.
Thank you. Well, I guess the biggest, I guess I have to say my favorite book is the one I've read the most. And that's Where the Wild Things Are. I read it to my kids. I read it to my granddaughter. I read it to the Sprout kids. It brings a smile to my face every time I read it. I must have read it 1,000 times. And I guess it doesn't always bring a smile to your face when your kids first learn the word again. I think we probably all experienced that, but it does bring a smile to the face, and so I
thank you. I was just imagining my sons shouting again and again. Building off of that and books, how will you support university and K-12 education?
Well, I think that stable funding for the university and the K-12 education is our most important way of supporting that. It is our constitutional responsibility to do that. The university system and a statewide system of public education are required in the Constitution for the legislature to do. This last year, I put forward a new law that forward-funded or early-funded education. That allowed us not to send pink slips to teachers across the state because the budget was late and they didn't know what they were going to, how many people they would be able to hire. I also strongly supported and worked on forward funding of education. So we forward funded education for next year, and that's going to allow our school districts to start early recruitment of teachers and keep the best teachers coming here. So I think forward and staple funding of education keeps teachers here, keeps the best teachers here, keeps classes small, and keeps our education system moving forward. I'd just like to say that the K-12 system here on the Kenai Peninsula is the best, or one of the best, across the entire state. We've got a high graduation rate, and I was really pleased that this year the graduation rate for Alaska Natives in the system was higher, actually, than that for the rest of the population. So we're doing something right, and so I really appreciate that.
I support a localized control of education, and any time that we can get our education within the hands of the community, it's going to make it stronger and more valid. I believe that we need to change the one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to Alaska, because we're a very broad state and vary in our needs from the top to the bottom. And so when we put parent choice as an option, we can allow for the teachers to teach according to the way the children learn. Every child learns differently. And so we need to allow the teachers to teach differently. And I am encouraged to see that our school district here has adopted the individualized learning plan and implementing that for each child, because that's going to strengthen them and allow them to grow wherever they are, whether it's in public school, private school, charter, or homeschool, and we can adapt to the needs of the children. I have four children myself and have been a homeschooling mom since my oldest started, and it's worked for her and she loves it. And we're a part of the Connections program here in the school borough, and she's always wanted to learn more in art. She's very creative. So we applied for her to be able to go take a class up at the high school. She finally made it in. The class number was able to accommodate her being in the building, and she's grown exponentially in her artistic skills under that teacher. That was something that I couldn't give her in homeschool, but by adopting the individualized learning plan to her needs, she's able to grow and thrive in an area that I wasn't able to give to her. And by expanding on that for each child, we can see the test scores come up and the teachers feel that they have been able to do their job, what they love doing, and that is teaching children to succeed.
So I just received three questions that had to do with education, and so I'd like to follow up a little bit. Ms. Vance, you elaborated to a certain degree about what you believe about the school district, and this question is, what will you do to support our Kenai Peninsula Borough School District and the high graduation rate we have compared to other districts around Alaska?
I will support the superintendent and try to partner in any way possible to be able to fill the needs here in our district. My first responsibility as a representative is to this district alone, and then to the rest of the state. We have some issues that we're facing here with the school, for Ketchumak-Salem, for instance, that the bond did not get passed because obviously it was a challenge for so many people to swallow such a big bill on a very small community. I think that we need to adapt the one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to school buildings to be able to fit some of these smaller communities, find out what they need and what is doable in some of these remote locations. That's going to have to be a conversation that we have with the superintendent and the borough and you, the voters. We need to be able to make some adjustments in our statutes to be able to accommodate these things, because they need a school building and you need to be able to have the assurance that it can be paid for and that they're getting a quality education.
What will you do to support KPBSD and the high graduation rates we have compared to other districts in Alaska?
Well, one of the things that we've talked about is, not here, but we've talked about with the borough, is the borough funding to the cap. And, you know, there's been complaints that we spend more per student than MATSU or Fairbanks. You got to realize that in the end, you got to look at the results. We have higher graduation rates than MATSU or Fairbanks. We don't get the $19 million that Fairbanks gets from the military that isn't counted in those figures. And we have the lowest dropout rate. So both at the top end and the bottom end, the borough funding to the cap, we allow 23% match. That's the federal maximum disparity test that can be used. You can't come in a school and pour a bunch of money into one school and no money into the other school per student, because that violates federal law, and then we lose federal funding. So it's 23% is the maximum that can be done on the local level, and our borough has stepped up to the plate, and the results are in the pudding. I mean, the high graduation rates, the low dropout rates show that they are working across the board in this district, and I've supported them all the way. We do need a stable funding for education, but you can't treat kids in one area different than kids in another area.
Building off of this, in light of the the school shootings that have taken place across the country, most recently in the last year, but definitely prior to that. How do you propose to keep students, but also all people safe from gun violence?
Well, that's a difficult difficult question, difficult solutions, I said. It's an easy question, but difficult solutions. We supported a resolution in the House on school safety, and those programs have been going forward. You hear about all the ALICE or the active shooter trainings that are taking place. But really, you need to get up front from that. You need school counselors. You need schools to be aware of students' mental health and going forward, making sure that you move upstream on that problem. And I supported the House Bill 75, which said that if with family members knew that somebody was having mental health problems or talking about suicide, those kind of things, that they could go to a peace officer, the peace officer could go to court, present the evidence to the court, and on a temporary basis, you could remove firearms from the home for 90 days. So it was a temporary basis, involved the court. The bill originally was looking at having a family member be able to complain to court, and we said, no, it's got to go through a peace officer because you could have domestic violence or domestic disagreement situations, and you need that peace officer verifying that these problems are occurring or the potential is in the home to go to the court. So that was a restriction there. So I think that that's one thing that we can do. We can also, you know, get rid of bump stocks. They're absolutely making an automatic weapon out of semi-automatic weapons are just unnecessary in Alaska, and that's something that could just be a real problem as we've seen down in Las Vegas.
Keeping our students safe from gun violence is going to be a partnership with the entire community, and it begins in the families. We need a proper education on not to fear the firearms. They are simply a tool just like anything else. We've seen that with different firearms being banned in different countries, and people who are angry will find something else. So I think education is a partnership that needs to take place that we can have with not only finding that that is not a method to express anger, but also with how we can deal with the mental issues. The majority of the major gun violence that we've seen in the news has been through people who had mental disorders and that were isolated and they were not a part of a larger community. When we have that partnership and we are able to have the conversation, then we can get past them seeing those tools to use as a weapon against another individual. And we need to build a stronger community in that conversation, not to have those individuals outlying in the shadows, but a part of a larger family where they're loved and supported and brought into that to where they can feel safe and protected.
A question that was provided. Alaska joined 30 other states when it passed Senate Bill 91. As a result of Senate Bill 91, reduced prison costs of $11 million per year have been invested into 1, increased pretrial supervision for bail, 2, substance abuse treatment, and 3, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sex Abuse. If you're in favor of repealing SB 91, what would you do with the $11 million per year? Would you eliminate these services? Or would you raise the $11 million per year elsewhere? And if so, specifically, how would you raise the money?
Yes, I'm a proponent of repealing SB 91. It has done its job, and its intent was to reduce recidivism in the state and keep people out of prison because it does cost the state money to house people in prison. But the what we're not being told is that we have at least a 66% recidivism rate within 3 years. And then at 9 years, it goes up even higher into the 90s. That means that after 9 years of incarceration, that they will return and become a repeat offender. So clearly, we're doing something wrong. But we have bared that on the backs of our citizens. We transferred that cost onto individual property owners and every individual in the state. It cost $45 million in property damage and loss in Anchorage alone, not counting the rest of the state. That is a shocking number. But it's not just the dollar value. It's how unsafe each one of us feel in our own homes, in our own communities. And many of you here have been affected by the high rise in crime. We do need to address that. And it means that we have to get the criminals off the streets, out of our neighborhoods, and into the prisons. But we do need reform. We have to go before that. The purpose is to reduce crime, not just put people in prison. We don't want to do that. We want to reduce crime. We do need to enhance the services, and we need to focus on the crime prevention. I did a trooper ride along, and I've spoken with superintendents of Spring Creek Correctional Center, and he said that we will not see a reduction in crime until we get a hold of our drug and alcohol abuse problem. It is tearing our families and our communities apart. We have to do something. But millions have been given into the mental health, and there's no accountability. They say, well, we know how many people came to visit our office, but did they get the help that they needed? Have they completed the time that they had there and walked away with the help that we had? I'd like to see accountability. As far as the funding that goes for that, I want to ask for another minute. I didn't want to just leave you hanging here for this question because it is affecting our state in such a big way. We're going to need to reprioritize safety as our number one priority. Government's number one priority was designed and should be public safety. No one can grow and thrive in education or in their homes or in their work unless they're feeling that they're safe. That should be our number one priority. We're gonna have to do some switching. We're gonna have to focus on a balanced budget, but we need to take and be able to advance into what we want in a community. And we have to have that conversation of how we feel that we're going to accomplish that before we can do that with a budget.
I supported the principles behind SB 91 because what they were trying to do was change the way we incarcerated people and what the outcome was. The outcome was two-thirds of people recidivated, or after they got out, they created another crime, created another victim within 3 years. That's really unacceptable. So we've studied around the world looking at different systems, trying to figure out what can we do, because other criminal justice systems have much, much lower recidivism rates. And so we need to change something. We were also having 40% of the people in jail had not been convicted of anything. They just couldn't pay the cash bail. So that was part of the design of the system, was to eliminate cash bail as the criteria, because people that didn't have enough money for the cash bail, they went to jail until it came, you know, 8-9 months until they went to trial. The rest of the people could get out. So the implementation of that was poor. And it was poor because there was design elements that took time to incorporate, such as hiring the bail control officers, the bail supervisors. If you don't have them when you start going and having automatic releases, then you don't have responsibility, you don't have accountability. So the problem was that the Senate went through and said, we're going to save $381 million in 5 years by not incarcerating these people. And so since we anticipate saving a certain amount of money this first year, we're going to take that out of the budget. Well, the savings didn't materialize, so that it was a real cut. And we lost 20 prosecutors, the courts were 4.5 days. All of these things came on top of the opioid epidemic, which really spun so much of the property crime, because you had people that were had never been drug users before, had never been involved in those systems, were now seeing opioid addiction leading to heroin addiction rampant throughout the state. And it's not only our state, it's states all across the U.S., especially rural areas. So we need to do some of those things that will get us there, and we have been. We've passed three separate bills repairing the SB 91. If you repeal SB 91, you get rid of those bail supervising officers, you get rid of ankle monitoring, you get rid of all those things that are necessary to repair the system as well. So we've passed three new bills that corrected those. In fact, Captain Case in Anchorage had said before they were, Anchorage, the police department was in favor of repealing SB 91. They are no longer asking for it to be repealed because the repairs are working. But they take time to implement and work as well. So I think, whoops, we're out of time. Thanks.
I don't want to belabor this this topic or this question, but I do feel that you both were able to provide your perspective on SB 91. However, the question, as I said, is quite dense, but it really is getting at the reduced prison costs of $11 million per year and how they have been invested into increased pretrial supervision for bail, substance abuse treatment, and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sex Abuse. If you are in favor of repealing SB 91, what would you do with the $11 million per year? Ms. Vance, you said that you would, so I'll let you follow up with that.
Well, we need to focus on a lot more prevention. The ankle monitoring system, I don't believe that very many people are happy with. They're having more issues, and people are still going and doing things that they shouldn't be. So obviously, we're going to have to go to more accountability. You know, what happened to the good old-fashioned community service that is able to have an accountability partner and able to invest back into the community? You know, the punishment needs to fit the crime, but we need to decide what that punishment looks like and what a debt to society looks like to us. We're that society. We're the ones that the crimes have been perpetrated against. And so we need to have a partnership in that. And the $11 million isn't just an easy number that we can throw around and say, well, it looks good here, it looks good there. Because we need to find out, there's a lot that's not working. We had intended it to do one thing, but clearly it's doing another. And we need to look at that. We need to go into having more dryout beds, more facilities. There are a lot of people who do want to get off of the drug and alcohol abuse, but they're not having the services provided available to where they are. We think it's no big deal to be able to go up to Kenai, you know, for a grocery run. But if you're someone who's out of prison and is trying to get dried out and your program is up in Kenai, you may not have the vehicle or the gas money to go up there and get that. We need to make it localized in each community. The other concern that I have is that it isn't being brought to the prisons. The money is there, but there are not people that are offering that drug rehab in the prisons where they are. So money is sitting there, but it's being unused because there's no one that is taking that solution directly to the inmates before they get out and released again. That's the conversation that we need to have. It may not always be about money, but it's about us making that partnership and availability to the people who need it most.
Well, I'm glad to hear support for increasing staffing that's needed. You know, it does cost money. I think the savings that we've got with the repairs to the bill are directed in the right places. We also added $12 million for this last year in the budget for drug rehab. So that is not inside the prison. That other money should be used there. But isn't it, you know, if you don't have people, it's hard to have a program. And so when people start talking about cutting the budget, you're really talking about cutting people. And so, you know, I totally agree that if you have the money allocated and you have no one to institute that because you want to cut the budget and have less state workers to actually perform the job, then you have a real problem because the cuts are causing the problem that you say you are trying to get rid of. So, you know, we did do a number of things. We reinstated so that C felonies, which are the minor felonies, can get 2 years in prison. And more than that with aggravators. So there have been a number of repairs that we did that are helping the system to make sure that accountability is there. And it is taking time to implement, because when you pass a bill, the money becomes available July 1st, and then it takes time to hire people, to get them trained up, to get them on staff, get them used to the system, and making sure that they know how to do the job. It's the same with the prosecutors. We added 5 or 6 new prosecutors and 1 drug prosecutor statewide. And it takes a while to get those in. The money became available July 1st. So I'm looking forward to a turnaround and many of the things, because of the 3 bills we passed, repairing SB 91 and repealing SB 91 would give us the old problems we had before.
I don't want to imply that drug and alcohol use and addiction is a crime, but both of you brought that up in your response to SB 91, and there's a couple of questions particular to opioid use. So with opioid use on the rise, what kind of actions have you taken on an individual level, at the local level, and also what actions should the state take?
Well, the actions I've been taking have been at the statewide level. We passed a bill that said the opioid prescription database was mandatory. There were only 14% of doctors using the opioid on the database on a voluntary basis, voluntary program, which meant that they were prescribing and not checking whether another doctor 2 days before had made the same kind of prescription. Now it's, the pharmacies have to every day upload what prescription they filled, and someone in the doctor's office that is licensed has to check that before they can issue a prescription for an opioid. We changed it so that instead of 30 days, we changed the standard of care so in an initial prescription you cannot give over 7 days of opioids. And we know that that 80% of cases can be solved in less than 3 days, and so we made it so that pharmacies that have the prescription, you can get it filled for less. You can get 1 or 2 or 3 days prescription, and the prescription stays valid at the pharmacy, so you don't have to go back to the doctor if you do need it. So this keeps some of the opioids out of your medicine cabinet hanging around. We also did an advance directive so that you can now do an advance directive as of the 1st of January to the hospitals and to the doctors saying that you don't want to receive any opioids. This is especially necessary for people that have been previously addicted to alcohol or tobacco or anything else, that know that they're more likely to become quickly addicted if they just follow the doctor's orders and take the prescription as required. So we've done a lot, and hopefully those are all moving forward, and we're going to be reducing this opioid use across the state.
Well, the personnel things that I have done regarding opioids is to take upon myself the simple responsibility of making use of what is available in our community with the little packets that dissolve the prescription drugs so that they don't go into our waterways or in our waste disposal. And there's many pharmacies and Elks Lodge and other members of the community have them available, and you can take your old prescriptions and put them in there with some water, and it deactivates the drug. That's something that each one of us can do if we have something, a different drug that didn't get used in the cabinet, that prevents others who it is not prescribed from taking it or stealing it and selling it elsewhere. And that's where a lot of the danger of this comes in, is the prescriptions getting into the wrong hands. And that's a simple thing that each one of us can do that will help reduce that level in our community. But I think we, in this conversation, we can't eliminate the issue of meth and other major drugs that are coming into our communities. And we need to be working with the border agents, with the airports, and the ports where so many of these illegal drugs come in. I mean, we all heard in the news where they found, they got, what is 33 pounds of meth at the ferry terminal, and that was headed towards Anchor Point. And if you talk to the people in Anchor Point, they all know who it was going to, and that was gonna hit our neighborhoods. And we need to tighten up on that security and stop it before it gets to our communities to create more addictions and more danger. And we can do that on a state level in a partnership with our borders, with the controls that we already have in place.
What can the state do about the rising costs of healthcare?
You know, this is something that I've had to research a little bit more. It's such a broad topic, and it's really become so important in our lives. But we have the opportunity to design the healthcare to the maximum benefit of Alaskans the way we want it. You know, we have an opportunity as a state to just take a fresh perspective at this, and we can look at the partnerships that we have for the federal reimbursement rate and work that out to where it's a little more reasonable and to our advantage. We can look at ways to minimize the over-utilizers and create a health accountability in our healthcare. Some of the things that legislature has passed recently is that the pharmacies are now free to give you a lower cost option on prescriptions. I believe it was passed about a month ago where the hospitals and the medical centers are able to disclose their basic services when requested. You can ask that. You know, a friend of mine had cancer earlier this year, and she needed 6 shots as part of her recovery. And they went up to Soldat and they kept asking, how much is this going to cost? How much is this going to cost? Oh no, I don't know, but you really need this. You got to have this. You got to have this. And they kept asking, we need to know how much this is going to cost. We have no idea. Well, this is a treatment that you really have to have. So they had some shots in Soldatna, and then they came down to Homer and needed one there. Well, after these 6 shots, they got the bill, and it was more than $70,000. They found out that the one here in Homer cost twice as much as us up in Soldatna. If we create an accountability and a transparency within our clinics, within our hospitals, then it will create a healthy competition and that will drive down the cost of healthcare by opening up to transparency and free market where you can decide where you want your care and what you can afford.
Well, the House did pass a healthcare transparency bill, which as of January will require all hospitals and providers to post their 20 most common procedures on the wall, and we even specified 20 font print. To make sure that people could do some shopping, you know, we're looking for competition, but competition really doesn't work in Alaska right now because you have so few providers and they all belong to the same organizations, and there's an 80% rule. There's a bunch of stuff we could talk about in the weeds, but it just doesn't work in Alaska. So what we're looking at now for competition is medical tourism. And so the school district here is working with Bridge Health, and Bridge Health comes in and says, we found this for a lot lower price, and we'll provide all that if you'll go somewhere else and do it. A great example is my wife. She needed a hip replacement. We had state insurance, and I called, and we found out from a person in Anchor Point that had gotten 2 surgeries that the hospital in Seattle was really great hospital. So I called down, and that was in network. But they, to find out whether we could get our transportation paid, I had to call and find out what the Alaska cost was. Well, the cost all in without any copay was $48,000 in Seattle. Here it was $108,000 plus the doctor, plus the anesthesiologist. Bridge Health is doing those every day for $27,000. dollars in other facilities outside. So there can be huge cost savings, but you know, our guys weren't interested in the competition, so we're looking at that as one of the ways to do there. You know, we really need to move upstream and build wellness into the whole problem and the whole thing on healthcare. And wellness comes in a bunch of forms, and mental health wellness as well. But one of the things that I've been advocating for a while and the Republican Party has beat me up on is we're trying to get people to realize that being low on vitamin D is terribly costly for Alaskans. 90% of people's vitamin D is made in their bloodstream with sun exposure. It's not here. We could save $37 million a year just on preterm births by having the vitamin D levels twice what they are right now. We could avoid 80% of breast cancer in women if we just were above 60, which is about three times where we the population is now. That's a lot of savings, folks, and yet we don't seem to be able to get there.
Seems that we're always following the money in some capacity. In the face of dramatically reduced revenues from the sale of oil and gas, how do you propose funding education and other essential services? Please be specific.
Well, we've cut our budget by 44%, 23% now in the operating budget. It's tough to get there where we are with those cuts. A few years ago, leadership started saying, well, let's do things differently. We always do audits, monetary audits, and they said, let's do performance audit. We spent several million dollars. We were going to do all the departments. After 3 years of doing these performance audits, we quit doing them because we weren't saving enough money to even pay for the audits. So we need to make sure that we have efficiencies, but we've already done that. So I proposed a four-pillar plan, and we passed that out of the House that would have got us out of this economic problem, but we'll have to talk that out in another question, I guess.
You still have some time.
Oh, still have another minute. Oh, good. So some of the cuts, I think the question was cuts. Oh, how would we do education funding? Yeah, well,
and other
the four-pillar plan that I proposed was reforming oil taxes, changing oil tax credits. We're getting really, pardon the word, screwed on that deal. We're paying 35% of all the expenses on North Slope oil companies. It makes no sense at all when they're paying 8% tax at $65 a barrel, 15% tax at $75 a barrel, but we give them a tax credit of 35% on all their expenses, no matter what the price is. So we need to change oil taxes. We need a broad-based tax across the state. People need to pay for something. That was one of my big problems with the Republican leadership that went to say everybody should get everything for free and nobody should pay for anything. And that's what we've done. They've said no taxes at all. And so that's, we need to change that.
We took in $2.5 billion in revenue last year, but we spent $4.6 billion. Clearly, we're going in the wrong direction. And we don't need to simply fill that gap, we need to close that gap. We're spending nearly $1 billion a month on expenses with only 740,000 people in the state. My question to you is, how much is enough? Clearly, we're not doing things as efficiently as we could. And I've been looking into the numbers, and I found that there was an Alaska CARES Act that was proposed in committee that would have consolidated the healthcare within our state workers to pool together, and it would have saved us $100 million. But it was fought against by a union, and it became a political football instead of a financial decision. It would not have reduced any services. It would not have reduced the size of our classrooms or messed with bus schedules, but it would have given the teachers the health care options that they needed, but saved us an incredible amount of money. There are many other ways that we can find to streamline and find the efficiencies in our government and reduce the overall spending and still maintain the services that we have. That's how I intend to do this, is to look at what we can find to trim the fat. We can build stronger economy. When we have a stronger economy, people rely upon the government services less because they're able to support and rely upon themselves. That's my proposal, is to focus on the stronger economy so that you can do what you do best, and that's thriving in your businesses, in your communities, in your jobs. And when you do that, then you aren't going to be coming looking for that help that you need, and we'll still be able to maintain the services that, like the roads and the bridges and everything else. And when we're having the good times, we can replenish our savings account and be able to have those for when the price of oil goes down. But we can also look to other ways of diversifying our economy, and that's where you come in as the people who do bring the innovations and the creative things that will bring the solutions to Alaska.
So there's a couple of more questions about the economy. Building on what you said, Ms. Vance, are there ways to raise revenues in Alaska without raising taxes? And I'm going to combine these two questions. And what would you cut out of the state budget at this point? Be specific.
Raising revenue, since I'm limited on time, I'll present an idea that I've been speaking to different state leadership about, and that's called the Alaska Modified Enterprise Zones. And that is inviting different companies and businesses to come utilize our empty buildings and properties that we have across the state. I heard from someone today that said, wow, there's been a lot of businesses closed down. There's so many empty buildings. And we can utilize that. We can create incentives for people to come in to build businesses and provide jobs here that don't rely upon our natural resources. We need to diversify so that we aren't in shock with our budget every time the price of oil goes down. We can rely upon the resource of Alaskans and the brains that you have, and using different industries like the technologies to be able to export something that doesn't rely on the shipping lanes. There are so many things that we can do, but we have to be able to bring those together. And this is an idea that would put it in the hands of the municipalities to determine the size and the scope of the business. And I don't mean sell the farm on making them big promises that we can't keep, but making something reasonable so that they can come in and utilize what we already have available and fill that space. But it can be something that we determine what it's going to be and what fits here in our own communities. And I think that we should use the Kenai Peninsula as a model. We have the Lowe's building up in Kenai that's now down to $2 million, and it's a beautiful space. We also have so many others right here in our own community that we would be able to use for maximum benefit for our marine trades and so many others. And I'm sure that many of you have ideas on some of those, but we need to have a partnership with other corporations to see that and also provide the education to be able to train people for those jobs so that we aren't having to stack up 2 and 3 jobs to make ends meet.
Can you repeat the question?
Are there ways to raise revenue in Alaska without raising taxes? And what would you cut out of the state budget at this point? Be specific.
In 2 minutes.
Okay. Yes, there are some ways we can raise revenues. We could cut the oil tax rate to 25% from 35%. Nobody pays the 35%, but guess what? You pay 35% of all their expenses because they write off the tax rate at 35%. And so for every $1 billion they spend, $350 million is subtracted from the taxes they give us. If we would lower their tax rate to 25%, you can see we could save $100 million right there. So that's one of the ways in which we could raise revenues. There are specific things we could do to cut. We could get rid of the 5 cents per pack tax credit that we give to tobacco companies for putting on the little stickers, the tax stickers on the on each pack. We could get rid of the deduction for cruise ships on their gambling taxes, and we could continue to reduce the education tax credits down to the 50% from the 100%. That's scheduled to come in, but I think that there will be many pushes to stop that from coming in. So we could continue all three of those things. Those would be tax cuts that we could make, but we could raise revenues in several ways, such as with the oil companies, without raising their taxes, actually lowering their taxes, lowers the amount that we pay in tax credits. So I guess that other than, I'll leave it there.
Whom do you support, Begich or Dunleavy, and why?
Well, that's a new one. Okay. I would just say I would not support Dunleavy under any conditions. Dunleavy says he's going to pay the full PFD without raising any taxes. That means the only thing he can do is raise the permanent fund dividend, the permanent fund, and that's going to decrease and eliminate the dividend over time, because right now we have a sustainable draw going long term at 5%. He would just reach in there and take whatever money he needed, that $1 billion a year more, or $870 million a year more, just to get to the pay the dividend, and it would come out of your kids and your grandkids' pockets, because there would no longer be a dividend in the future. I do not think that's a way to approach the finances of the state of Alaska. We have responsibilities to balance the budget, but not by just depleting the savings to zero.
Since we're talking about Dunleavy, I'm voting for Dunleavy. And the reason that I am voting for him is because I agree with his vision for Alaska. He speaks of Alaska as a land of opportunity, and he sees what we can become together. He believes in Alaskans, and that we have this partnership in government. He is not going to be the end all. It is going to be us, as a people, working together on building a future here in Alaska. That begins with us as the voters, and then moves up to the representatives who represent you, because the governor cannot do anything without the approval of the legislature. And so the legislature is directly tied to you as the voter. He is not going to be the one that can wave his wand and make things happen. He believes in you. And that's why I am going to vote for him, because he believes in limited government, and the power is in the hands of the people. And we can make these decisions together on what Alaska can become.
Do you have an idea for increasing options for public transportation on the Kenai Peninsula?
The first thing that popped in my head was bicycles. I don't know why. You know, with the new bicycle shop downtown, they have made it look so much fun. You know, the Ninilchik tribal has started their transport program with a van that comes in taxis in between Ninilchik and Anchor Point and Homer for shopping needs or whatever people in the community need. And I think that's a great partnership, that you don't have to get a taxi or ride your bike, but you can use an available resource and not have to be the driver, because I know that there's many in our community who can't drive for whatever reason. And so if we use this type of partnership with different groups, it can make our resources pool together and be able to fill a need that we have. And, you know, I see many people in Homer Communications that are saying, hey, I'm going up to Anchorage. Anybody got a need to ride? So I think if we continue on that path, we'll be able to open up to more transportation.
Well, from the state perspective, as a representative, we do some grants for carts and other things. Those are the transportation things that we can do. We don't have the money to come in and make a big public transportation fund. So I'm going to use the little time that I have here because that's to ask you to look at this chart. If you look at this chart that says impact of paying a $3,000 PFD, which is basically what one of the candidates for governor wants to do, you'll see in the blue, that's our 19 budget, all of the different departments. You see in red, that's if we pay a 3,000 PFD. Those are the only things that get funded. There are 17 agencies that would get zero funding, 17 departments, corrections, public safety, fish and game, all of those ones that do not have a red bar next to them get zero funding, and all of those personnel get laid off, and that's about 15,000 people. So take this home, consider it, and see if that's really what you want for the state of Alaska.
As we get down to the last couple of minutes here, to be clear, how do you plan to vote on ballot measure one?
I will be voting no on ballot measure one, based on the principle that it goes against our American value of being innocent until proven guilty. I believe this ballot measure does quite the opposite, and it says that we have to prove that any runoff, any water source is not supported by autonomous fish. And that says that we are inherently guilty in that sense until it can be proved through environmental study. I believe that it is very vague and dangerous. I support salmon, but I believe that we need to go through the proper channels of legislation and have those talks, have those discussions on finding the protections necessary. But this measure is something that will disrupt the entire state, and I'm voting no.
Well, I'm voting yes on ballot number one. We need new standards. We need some standards in statute for the development of projects. This ballot measure, although it's written in technical language because it's the law, if you go to the statutes and start reading the law, you'll have the same kind of problems understanding those things. But what it really does is establishes three kinds of permits. A major permit that is going to significantly impact anadromous fish habitat for a long time. And that will be looked at by the Commissioner of Fish and Game, will make those decisions. There are also general permits, which are we now have, for routine activities that you use. And there's minor permits that are if you're conducting something that has a very temporary or minor impact on anadromous fish, then that would be very easy to get just like they are right now. It's a large scale permits that would require much more work.
So I think we have about 2 minutes left, which works out just right for each of you to have a 1 minute closing.
Thank you so much for coming, and I hope that you got to know us a little bit better, but I do want to wrap up with the emphasis that I believe in you as the government. We're Alaskans, we get to make the rules, and I would be representing every one of you in this room, and I want to take what you have to the legislature and apply it with the great minds of the people who are elected there and find the solutions that we have as a state. I believe the permanent fund belongs to the people of Alaska. We are each shareholders in the wealth and in the opportunity of this state, and that we can do this together. We don't have to result into being scared of what our opportunities and what the future has for us. We can grasp it, and we can take hold of it, and we can build this brighter future together. So thank you so much for coming. You can find me on my website at saravance.org or on Facebook at Vote Sarah Vance. And if you have any more questions, please reach out to me because I want to hear about your questions and your concerns so that I can take those. And I appreciate your vote. Early voting starts next week on October 22nd. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming. This has been a really good forum. I hope you've been able to get some sense of the two candidates. I believe that we have a fiscal problem that we need to solve. We can't ignore and just keep robbing our savings accounts. I proposed a four-pillar plan that actually solved our budget crisis, and we wouldn't be in this hole we are right now if we had passed that when the House passed it in 2017. And we could have compromised with the Senate, but they offered no compromise at all. They were just saying no to everything until, and in fact, as Pete Kelly said, the Senate was not going to institute any new revenues until they quit paying all the PFD. So anyway, I support the PFD. I support Alaskans moving forward. I support education, and I hope that you can see my website, Vote Paul Seaton, as well as on Facebook. And you can call me at 299-3434. And I appreciate it, and please vote on by the 6th. And I would appreciate your vote. Thank you.
I just want to say on behalf of the Friends of the Homer Library, I want to thank you both for participating, and to all of you, thank you for coming out and voicing your ideas. As both of them have said, of course, remember to vote. Good night.